Tonight we're going to discuss a book which may enable you to fulfill a lifelong ambition. It's called The Beachcomber's Handbook, and it's by Ewell Gibbons. Mr. Gibbons also wrote Stalking the Wild Asparagus, Stalking the Blue-Eyed Scallop, and Stalking the Healthful Herbs, each of them published by McKay. And we will be back with Mr. Gibbons and The Beachcomber's Handbook in just a moment.
This is BookBeat, a program that each week introduces you to leading authors and critics as they discuss the newest and best books in print. Your host is Robert Cromie, book editor of the Chicago Tribune.
Mr. Gibbons, I'm intrigued, among other things, by the fact, before we get actually to your Beachcomber's Handbook, by the fact that you have a kind of hobby of scouring whatever countryside you're in and cooking what's available and making a complete meal.
Yes, I do that. This has been something I've been fascinated with all my life, the fact that a person could go out in the wilds and pick up perfectly good food without having to pay for it.
Well, it would be pretty hard to starve you to death anywhere then, wouldn't it, except possibly the desert?
Well, even the desert at the right time of the year has plenty of food on it. It is possible to starve to death on a desert, and it's also be a little hard to pick wild plant food in case of the ground's frozen and the snow is deep. But at that time, of course, wild game becomes easier to get. So it's very hard to starve anyone to death who knows what's good to eat out in the wilds.
Well, for instance, what could you get in say, Illinois?
Well, once in Chicago, right here in Chicago, I picked 16 edible plants from a vacant lot. I didn't eat them because I don't like the smog and smoke and things that are on them, but I was able to find 16 different edible plants on a vacant lot out in the University District.
Now, would these have sustained life?
Oh, certainly. I mean, in fact, not only sustained life, they would probably have been more nourishing than most of the domestic vegetables that people raise because they have a little higher vitamin content and mineral content.
But, I mean, you could literally live on them for months if you had to.
I suppose you could. I never have lived on them for months at a time. I once lived for about 3 weeks on wild food when I was about 12 years old, and since that time I've several times gone for a week at a time. This is a sort of a stunt, something that I enjoy doing, going out and just seeing whether I can or not, and such trips always become kind of continuous feasts. I overeat. In fact, in most cases, I gain weight when I'm on such a...
Does this include wild game?
Not always. Last fall, we went out, another man and I went out and spent 6 days, and we deliberately decided to make it entirely vegetarian, not use any game or fish, whatever, and we were out for 6 days. We ate over 30 different kinds of food, and I gained 2 pounds, and he gained a half a pound in the 6 days.
Now, what could you do if you were at sea?
Well, out in the far at sea, I mean, there are occasionally fish, of course. People on the Contiki found out that this is all nonsense about fish not being far at sea if you're down close enough to the water to attract them. Along the seashore, anywhere, anyone who starves to death along the seashore, there's something wrong with his eyesight. There's food everywhere along the seashore. Yeah. My wife and I started out one time and spent a month going into various places cold that we didn't even know. We went all the way from North Carolina to New Brunswick and just go in at places cold that we didn't know, pick out on the map where we were going, and we never failed to find enough food for a meal any place that we went into the sea.
Well, it's a fascinating, it's a hobby and, of course, a life work for you now.
Yes, it was a hobby up until finally my agent persuaded me to write a book on it, and I found out it's also the hobby of a great many other people. I was very much surprised to flush so many foragers out of the brush.
Well, now, when did Stalking the Wild Asparagus come out?
1962.
And this has been selling consistently ever since.
Oh, yes. It's still one of my best-selling books right now.
It's in many editions. It's in like a fifth edition or sixth edition or something.
Sixth or seventh now.
But the Beachcomber's Handbook involves Hawaii.
Yes.
Particularly.
Yes, particularly Hawaii, although since that's in the tropics and the tropical plants go around the world, especially on islands, particularly on islands, I am not... talking about inland tropics in this case, but the beaches in the tropics.
And this isn't a gag title. You literally were a beachcomber for 3 years in Hawaii.
Well, beachcomber, yes, but not the thing that people see, this romantic type thing that people have seen on television and movies.
But I mean, you lived off the land.
Yes, I lived off the land. I lived on the wild fruits and plants that I could get from the shores and from the mountains and from fish and seafoods that I could get from the sea. Not entirely. I would say 90 to 95% of all my food came from this source, and occasionally I would trade some fish or some nuts or something of that sort to a grocer for something to go with it, because there are a few things that you do need, like cooking oil and other things that are not very easy to get in the wild. They can be gotten, but not very easily.
Well, no, well, this was on Oahu.
On part Oahu of it. And part of it, and then finally on Maui, after I married my wife, who turned out to be a pretty good beachcomber herself. We moved over to Maui, and we continued this as a sort of a hobby there, although we didn't live in a grass shack as I did on Oahu.
Well, you had you thatched your own shack on Oahu.
Oh, yes,
on Oahu.
Yes, I thatched my own shack, and in fact, I think that was the first coconut palm thatched shack that had been built there for a number of years. The Hawaiians were very interested in it when they saw me building it.
You had to help teach them how to do it.
Yes, well, they taught me how to weave the mats that we put on the outside, and they wanted to weave even the roof, but I wanted it loose, hanging down, and then sheared the edges of it. It made a very, very nice-looking little thing out of it. It was done more for looks than anything else. I wanted to feel at home in this way. Really, it was a bit of a fraud. I had a electric range, electric refrigerator, and a shower bath inside, flush toilet.
But nonetheless, starting with those things, you lived without money for 3 years, or you could have lived without money.
I had as much money at the end of the time as I had at the
beginning
of the time. I sold a few fish in this time, and occasionally did a little turning of hardwood bowls from some of the tropical hardwoods on a lathe that I had.
And you made some things from coconut shells.
Yes, I made things from coconut shells, too, and a little craft work of this kind, and I sold a few nuts and some... And as I say, fish and seafoods occasionally, when I had a surplus.
Well, you found some Indian nuts and traded them or sold them through a Chinese merchant.
Well, that was the Indian almond. The it's a large, corky thing, I developed a method of getting them open pretty well, and it has the inside of it is a little larger than the pine nuts and has a flavor somewhat like pecans, and I used to package some of those up and
sell them for
bags
a dime,
and sell them through a Chinese friend of mine.
Well, you and your friend was a Jim, the
yes.
fellow who had the Hawaiian wife.
Yes, well, Samoan wife.
Samoan wife, pardon me, and his son.
Yes,
Hugo. Went actually set up a little fishing business. Well, it was a big one actually.
Well, we were catching lobsters with nets, the spiny lobster with nets, and we also had a number of fish traps over in Kaneohe Bay and. This brought in some income, but I had to get out of that. This was almost becoming a business. You know, people think of beachcombing that the big hazard is maybe women and liquor and the deterioration of the white man in the tropics. I found the greatest hazard was this constant pressure and temptation to get a job and reform and be respectable. You have to fight that with everything you've got.
Well, how about that promising beachcomber who was trapped by the fact that he started making money deflowering coconut palms?
Oh, yes, yeah, that was a friend of mine who started in, you know, they deflower coconut trees over there so they won't bear nuts.
So they won't fall on the people.
Yeah, so they won't fall on the people, and he started doing that, and it got to be quite a thing, and then he also was taking the nuts off the trees, and he hated to throw those away, so he got a
pig
sow and started raising pigs, and the next thing you knew, he was in the pig farm business, and was becoming rather wealthy and driving a Cadillac and living in a split-level house and married to a native girl and a big bunch of Hapahali children in the house. And he'd lost his identity as a beachcomber entirely by that time.
Well, of course, you've really lost yours because you now live in Beavertown, Pennsylvania, where there's no beach.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I succumbed to some of the hazards that I've talked about, too, you know. I got married.
Yeah, and you write and lecture.
Yes.
But always on your pet subject.
Always on my pet subject, and I don't think that I have completely lost my identity. One time there was a reporter who said that I had learned to find my South Seas anywhere I went, and I do try to do that. You know, you don't have to go to a tropical island to practice this sort of thing. In fact, when people ask me, what kind of aptitudes do you need? Would I make a good beachcomber? Well, one of the first things I ask them is, do you do anything like that where you are now? Do you take advantage? Do you go hunt mushrooms? Do you pick wild berries? Do you gather the nuts that you can find? Do you know any of the wild foods? Do you ever gather any of them? If you don't do anything like that, what makes you think you'd change if you go to a tropical island?
I wouldn't make a very good one. We have a pear tree in our front yard, and the pears fall and rot. We have nut trees, and they fall, and I step on them, and they grow other trees. But
I've seen that happen in Hawaii. I saw a woman over there who had over 50 coconut palms on her place, and one day I happened to go by there to leave a message that someone had sent, and I was on my way to a picnic, so I asked her if I could have some of the nuts for drinking nuts to take for a beverage on the picnic, and she said, well, sure, help yourself. And then she followed me around, and finally she got up nerve enough and asked me, how did you go about drinking one of them?
These are from the green coconuts.
Yes, from the green coconuts. And I showed her how to open a coconut and drink the water from it, and then I began to talk to her about it and found out that in the 5 years she'd lived there with 50 coconut palms on her place, she had never used a coconut in any way. Never had. And I asked her if she never made a coconut cake or pie, and she said, oh, yes, but I buy the coconut...
Down at the store.
She never used these. Said they were just a nuisance. She had to hire people to haul the coconuts away.
Well, how many ways can you use a coconut? Coconut tree, now, because there are other things beside the...
I would be talking the rest of the day if I went into all of the possible uses of the coconut. It is a tremendously useful tree in the tropics. Now, we very seldom just ate ripe coconut like people do here. The green nut we used as a beverage, open it up while it's still so full that you couldn't... It wouldn't slosh if you shook it.
It's water of a kind, isn't it?
Yes, but it tastes like it's slightly carbonated. You can take the husk off, and you'll see the little eyes begin to push out from pressure within. Open those up, and it's always cool. This shell, evaporation from the shell, always keeps it cool, even in the tropics. So it's a wonderful drink at that time. And then you can open the coconut, and you have what they call a spoon meat, a sort of jelly-like meat, only a few spoonfuls in each coconut, but very delicious. Tastes like a pudding or something of the sort. Then we made coconut milk or coconut cream by putting boiling water on the grated up meat and squeezing it out, which extracts some of the oil. And it looks like milk. You can let the cream rise on it. You can whip this cream, or you can churn it and make a coconut butter out of it. You can use it in a pudding that's called haupia in Hawaii. And there are a number of dishes that you can make from the coconut cream, a very useful thing. And then the bloom itself, maybe I shouldn't tell people too much about this, but if it's handled just right, it's quite an art to get one of them to actually running well. But you can start running a palm wine from the bloom by cutting it and binding it just right.
A growing distillery, sort of.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly a distillery, it's sort of winery. Mm-hmm. And this will ferment within one day, so it doesn't take you very long to get enough to make quite a...
And don't you get heart of palm, or whatever they call it?
The heart of palm, the palm cabbage, some people call it, although I dislike that, because this is as much better than cabbages. Artichokes are better than turnip greens. It's the very heart where the young leaves are going. This kills a tree. It can only be taken when people are chopping down a tree for some other purpose, but you can find that where there's development's going on, and find trees that people have cut down, and not many people know how to do this. You can get it out sometimes a piece of almost snow-white, crisp, tender, delicious stuff, sometimes as big around as your leg and almost as long, not quite about that long. And this is called a millionaire salad. It's really a delicious salad material. I love it. Take a wild avocado, open it up, and chop up some of the heart of palm, and then take some of the crab meat and maybe a little pineapple that you steal out of the field.
Well, I guess I know from your book that you've been asked this, but why did you leave this paradise that you were in?
Well, that's quite a story. I mean, one of the things is that I started it with the idea of only doing it for a limited length of time. I didn't intend to spend my whole life at this. I wanted to see what life was like in this, and then I feel that life has other experiences to offer me. It was also partly accidental. I got married a Pennsylvania girl that I met in the University of Hawaii, and she wanted to come back to the States, and I came back, and I found out that you didn't have to be in a tropical island. As soon as I got back to Pennsylvania, I began to find out that there's pretty good South Sea islands around there.
Yeah, it's that your being at the University of Hawaii was an odd circumstance in itself, because how many grades of formal schooling did you have? Four?
Well, 5 years that I went to school altogether before I entered the university. I mean, of course, that was many years before, but I had done quite a bit of studying.
Well, obviously, yes. Yeah. You and Mari Sandoz, you know, the writer who did the Indian books, had, I think, 5 years of schooling, and, of course, was a very brilliant woman. But how did you get into the university with only that much formal schooling?
Well, I went to the McKinley High School in Honolulu. They have an adult high school, and they started giving me tests, and they, what they call a diagnostic test, and then I finally, after I think it was 29 hours of testing, they decided I didn't have to go to high school, and they gave me a diploma.
Well, that's the easy way.
Yeah, so I went through high school in 29 hours.
How many fish, by the way, to get away from the coconuts, how many fish are there off the coast of Hawaii that you can, edible fish? Hundreds of species?
Well, I would say there are probably more than 100 species there. They're among the commonly caught ones, 3 or 4 dozen different kinds. And it's a peculiar thing in Hawaii. One never says, I'm going fishing.
No, you said they go and say, I'm going to catch this certain type
of
fish, and they do it.
I'm going out lava fishing, or I'm going out mahi-mahi fishing. I'm going out each time. Name the fish that you're going for, because you use a different technique for each one of them. This is quite a lore. You can go on and on all day about Hawaiian fishing, because you go out for certain types of fish. Now, of course, with the short casting, you're casting for maybe 3 or 4 different kinds. Usually there are only 2 different kinds that you'll catch in one place, but about that.
And some exotic ones. Octopus, for instance, you learned to like very much.
Oh, yes. The first octopus I ever ate, I didn't even know what I was eating, and I loved it, and I couldn't go against it after that. So I found that octopus is a very delicious fish, a very delicious seafood. It's really a mollusk, you know, akin to the clams and oysters, and it has some of that flavor, too, a little more chewy and a little more to it. And a very delicious flavor can be fixed in many ways. In fact, you can even eat it raw.
How large did they get, by the way? Because you said that the octopus was not dangerous, but the giant squid is dangerous, isn't it?
Well, I've never had any experience with the giant squid. The octopus that we have over there is not dangerous. I have never seen any sign of danger from the octopus in Hawaii. Four or five feet would be the total spread of the tentacles. Which mean half of that for each tentacle is about the size that you usually get there. The Hawaiians have no fear whatever of them. We often caught them out on the reef at night, and the Hawaiians would just take the octopus and put it on their chest or on their back or on their neck and let him seize a hold of them and go ahead and catch another one.
But the eel is very dangerous.
The eel is very dangerous. I've known a number of people to be bitten by an eel. In fact, I had a finger bitten by a small eel one time when I was gathering cowrie shells. But it wasn't a very bad bite.
But they can take a finger off, can't
they? Oh, yes, they can.
Or a hand,
so
even.
So this business of sticking your hand into holes around the reef is something you want to be very careful about. In fact, it shouldn't be done at all, because very often there are eels in there. Although I had a friend who, when we were catching the lobsters, he said he could always tell when there was an eel in a hole, because the spiny lobster would have one tentacle forward and one tentacle backward.
When there was an
eel in the hole behind him. Well, somehow he's sensing to see whether the eel is going to come for him. But we used to have a little rag tied on the end of our spear, and we would stick it in behind him and then give it a shake, and he'd come running out, and you could catch him anyway, so you didn't have to.
Well, you found some odd things on Oahu, I guess, or Maui, one of the two islands. You found apples, peaches, things you didn't expect.
Yes, I found in the high altitudes of Maui, the Forest Department had planted some apple trees, and I had a friend up there who had a peach tree. And, of course, on Kauai, they have plums, regular plums. There is a native plum which is not really related to our plums, belongs to a different family entirely, not even closely related to domestic plum. But the plums that they have on Kauai are regular prunus. Those belong to the same family as our plums here. They come from here, but in a very high altitude, you do have, it's seasonal enough so that they will grow. They have to have frost, but you can get frost in those high altitudes.
And, of course, bananas are plentiful. You'd find wild bananas and kind of stake them out and wait until they became ripe. I remember one of your stories in which you went back to gather 2 huge bunches, and as you were walking in to get them, a very large gentleman, a Hawaiian gentleman, was coming out with them over his shoulder.
Yes, I never forget that. After I used to mark on my calendar, when I would find a nice bunch of bananas, well, I would judge when they were going to be ripe, and then I would mark that on my calendar to go back and get this bunch of bananas. And this time somebody else had marked a calendar the same day I had, I guess, so he was coming out with the bananas. These were Bluefields, too. They're an excellent, the same kind that we get in the supermarkets around here.
Well, nobody objects, really, to your foraging as long as you do it discreetly and politely.
Yes, that's the general thing. I've never been bothered over there, the large landowners, the ranchers, the plantation owners, and things of this kind. They didn't mind me taking the wild stuff. sometimes I would get permission from people, and very frequently, though I've gone into land, I didn't even know who owned it. Go back into the valleys where the ancient Hawaiians used to live, where they had planted a lot of these trees themselves and then abandoned it.
You found potatoes.
I found potatoes on the island of Maui up on the Haleakala. That was a very strange one because I was sitting and looking at those plants and thought they looked familiar, but it was so strange to find potatoes there that it just never occurred to me they were potatoes. And, of course, they were bearing seed balls on them. And I was very surprised in a sort of a wet meadow in the slopes of Haleakala. But I understand that way back when, people used to raise potatoes up there to trade with the whaling vessels that came to that area, and they allowed some of them to go wild. So,
and grapes you found?
Yes, they have one kind of grape. It's actually a descendant from our eastern fox grape, but a special kind that grows over there.
What about poisonous foods? Did you ever get poisoned eating anything yourself?
In Hawaii, I never had any trouble whatever with that, and the I never have anywhere. The people are always asking questions about this poisonous thing. You see, you learn to recognize the wild foods you're eating the same way that you learn to recognize the domestic foods, and you do it in the same way. There is no rule where you can tell a poisonous one from an edible one. That's the way most people ask the question. Say, well, how do you tell the poisonous ones from the edible? And I'm sure they want me to tell them that every plant has a little thing growing on it, and if it curls up this way, it's edible.
Or if it's shiny.
Or something of this sort. And it just simply isn't true. They don't have them. And you learn to recognize the edible plants.
In other words, you don't eat anything strange.
No.
You know what you're eating.
I don't just run through the woods and graze. I always know what it is that I'm picking. That it's an edible species before I eat it. And this is not too hard to find out. I should say it's not. It's a bit hard. It used to be a bit hard to find out, because I have had to look in a great many places for this. But primitive man long ago learned what plants were edible and which plants were not, and this knowledge has not been completely lost. It's sometimes a bit hard to find, but it still is available, and I happen to be one of those people who are digging this knowledge out from the various places, books on ethnobotany and reports of early explorers and people who report on habits of native ethnologists in various...
Well, in effect, you shop through the fields as if you were shopping in a supermarket.
Oh, yeah. I very often make out a shopping list before I start out.
Do you really?
But I do a little impulse buying, too. Sometimes nature offers something that I didn't expect, and I take that, too.
Well, now, you gave a party in Mundelein, Illinois, on wild... the whole meal was wild foods. What was there in it?
Well, the main dish happened to be fish that I caught from a little lake up there. These were...
Loch Lomond.
Yes, yeah. Bluegills are sunfish, and I have learned to fillet them, and then I cook them in a Japanese tempura batter, which makes a very good food out of them. We had milkweed buds, and which are like broccoli with character. There was a wild mustard that we had as greens, and we had wild black raspberries and blackberries. And some ground nuts, which are a little like a potato. There were about a dozen different foods that we managed to get, some of them in small quantities, some of them in large quantities, some of them we mixed together. I once gave a dinner of this kind on Long Island, and my guest for that day was Craig Claiborne, who's the food editor of the New York Times. And that day I had such an embarrassing wealth of food. I went down to Mount Sinai Harbor and I managed to get 7 different kinds of seafood. This included 3 different kinds of clams, 4 different kinds of clams, and oysters, mussels, and periwinkles. And I also got fish, blowfish, called sea squab. Well, I cooked the sea squab as a sort of fish dish, and the others, I didn't know. You can't just keep having one seafood dish served after another. So I merely ground them all up or chopped them all up and mixed some breadcrumbs and other things with it, and then put it back into the shells and put a little strip of bacon over the top, and I put it on the menu as a sort of...
The bacon was cheating, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. I cheat all the time. I don't, ordinarily with these wild parties, I don't make any pretense that that I don't use some civilized stuff. You see, there's two different things we're talking about.
Well, in the first place, you aren't a faddist. You don't insist on wild food.
No, yeah. Not at all. I eat very much as other people do. This is a hobby with me, and while we do occasionally give wild parties where everything is wild, and we go off, my wife goes with me sometimes on expeditions where we go off and live for as much as a week on the natural food. One time we borrowed a couple of children and took them along. All four of us lived for 5 days straight, 15 meals, without eating anything that was came from the store. Yeah. Lived entirely off the land.
Now, there are a lot of people who like this and who have adopted this hobby or had it and are delighted to find your books. Yeah.
Yes, I was surprised to find how many people love this. It seems to be a funny sort of interest. Well, there's a growing interest because of people having these survival schools in the services, and the Boy Scouts are taking this up to some extent now, too, of teaching survival, although I'm still trying to teach them that the right way to do it is not to teach them survival, but rather teach them to eat wild foods on the wild party basis of going out and on a hike and seeing how many things they can gather and how many they can eat, because then they really learn them.
But could for instance, somebody drop you in a countryside and drop a city person who knew nothing about this, the chances would be very good the city person might starve to death and you'd come out fatter than, well, I won't say fatter than ever, that would be impolite, but fatter than whatever you were when you went in.
Yes, that is true. There have been a great many people starve and a great many people suffer from malnutrition. It was perfectly useless. I mean, they were surrounded by food at the time they did, but they just simply didn't know what they could eat. And I find that there's food everywhere. I have never been in a place where I didn't notice that there was wild food. Some people wouldn't even believe this, that I see wild food as I'm driving. I see it on each side of the road. Of course, my wife says that I look at it too, so she drives if she's going along with me. I'm looking at that instead of looking at the road. So.
Well, we must say, before we get to the end, that your books all contain recipes also for preparing the food.
Oh, yes. Half of this hobby is cooking. And I must say to any man who wants to take up this as a hobby, don't go out and gather a bunch of dirty roots and some greens and come in to your wife and say, look what I brought you. It won't be very popular, I'm sure. But if you come in and prepare it and make it a dish and then bring it to the table, you'll be appreciated.
What about wintertime? Would you be fairly lost in the Arctic, for instance?
Probably in the Arctic, although there are certain things like the rock lichens which grow on sheer faces of rock, which are very edible and will sustain life for an awful long time. There are certain tree barks that can be eaten.
But in an average winter, you could dig and find things, I suppose.
Well, if the ground is not frozen so you couldn't possibly get into it, you can find things everywhere. And around where I live, we went out last fall. It was in November 17th when we started.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to let that one go. Oh. We've been talking with Yul Gibbons, author of The Beachcomber's Handbook, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, and a couple of other books about his hobby, which is finding food in the wilds and eating and cooking it. I'm Bob Cromie of the Tribune. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and I do recommend the book most highly. If you have any bent this way at all, you'll find it fascinating. And thank you very much. We must have a wild party sometime.
Yes, come over and we'll see what we can do.
Good. Thank you.